Yeah, and then I also realized when I got to the show, I forgot the SD card. So that was the other thing.
Yeah, that was a... I really loved Duster playing live. But, I mean, I love a few Codeine songs, but I found it so much more, I don't know, less convincing than Duster for some reason.
Yeah, I think with Codeine, I mean, we had kind of discussed how, like, slow music can be boring, and I feel like that kind of comes through, like, if you try to listen to too many of their albums, like, close together, like, a sort of sameness to it. Like, there are some Codeine songs that I really like, but at the same time, they also just sounded like their album, which was something that was, like, kind of not thrilling for me.
Yeah.
But I also found it strange, like, the setting of the show, because this was at Olympia, and you have, like, these bands that I associated with, like, Codeine's a little bit larger in terms of sound, I guess, but, like, Duster, it seemed really out of place.
Yeah, it was a bit out of place. The whole lineup was a little bit weird as well. After that, the vibe shifted pretty considerably. Yeah, I mean, it was a great show. I was kind of... It was funny, because I thought, like, the show was so busy, and then last... Like, when I was kind of trying to put together the album release show for our EP in January, I was, like, looking for slowcore bands in Montreal, and I was, like, thinking, like, oh, there are all these people at the Duster show. Like,
oh, yeah.
So at least a few of them have had to have, you know, been influenced by what they saw and have made bands that are sort of, I don't know, in that world at least. And I was struggling to find... and I guess there's a few kicking around now, but I was kind of, and I'm sure that more will crop up, but I was surprised that it hadn't yielded like a bunch of projects.
I totally agree. I feel like slowcore, post-rock, like whatever you want to call it, like slow, sparse music is pretty like sparing throughout all of Canada. Like Like, for running the show, I've dug to try and find stuff. And there was, of course, like, a lot of post-rock coming out of Canada, but, like, of the very, like, the Godspeed variety, right? But I feel like I've seen, there was probably, like, an uptick of this stuff, like, in the 2010s when, like, the online, like, this rediscovery of Duster first occurred. But then at the same time, like, I feel like I haven't seen that so much in Canada, because I feel at that time a lot of people were influenced by, like, the post-punk scene coming out of Calgary. Whereas, like, if you look just south to, like, New York State, there are tons of really slow, lots of, like, bedroom project bands, but, like, also actual, like, multi-piece bands coming out of there that were playing very, like, stuff... Well, I don't know how much I could say it was, like, influenced by, like, Duster specifically, but there are, like, obviously tons of people that, like, rode that wave. But there's a lot of interesting stuff that came out of there.
Well, that band you sent me, Picastro.
Yeah.
I really, really, really loved that song that you sent me. Thought it was really cool. So I did a bit of a... Did some research into them, and I actually saw that they're still playing shows every once in a while. And I don't know, it seemed like they kind of had a decent run of things, like they were touring Europe a lot, and but somehow I never heard of them. But they were really awesome, so I'd love to set something up with them in Toronto sometime, maybe.
Yeah, man, that would be really sick. I see, for me, like, my interest in them was kind of relegated to, I think, their first two albums, which were like Red Deer Blues and Metal Cares. And then I mean, it could be something that I just like revisit, and then I'll, you know, have some fondness for it, but like their later albums just did nothing for me, so I just never like thought to look for them like playing shows. So
well, that's the thing also. Yeah, I guess I haven't listened to the later stuff, so
yeah,
when you book someone, you're probably gonna get their most recent incarnation, not what you want to hear from 20 years ago.
Yeah,
but that's another thing with like when Duster and Codeine play live, it's always a bit strange, I think, when I don't know, like seeing the Pixies live nowadays, or even like, you know, the corpses of the Rolling Stones on stage. Like, it's, there's so much of just like re-inhabiting these old sort of songs and old characters And I don't know, there's, it's not that, obviously people can still make compelling rock music at an older age, but there's...
You're saying it very politely.
No, I mean, 100%. I'm not being facetious about that. But sometimes there is an impression of, like, this shell of a past or something.
Yeah. I think it's also strange to see, like, the comment I made earlier about, like, my expectation of what it would be like to see a band like Duster live. Because mm-hmm. It was strange to see them in that setting where, like, this music that I became, like, really intimately familiar with, like, always just being played over, like, my bedroom speakers. Mm-hmm. And then seeing that, like, filled out to a stage, okay, here are the real people. Because I feel like that's also, like, a really different dimension to, like, I don't know, music discovery has always been, like, unless you're discovering a musician by doing it live, you're always divorced. You're, mm-hmm. like, listening to it through some other medium. But it is strange when it comes out of, like, a particularly... music that you imagine to be small. And I feel like that's kind of how I view a lot of, like, slowcore. Or, like, music that gets called slowcore, because mm-hmm. it's in reality really broad. But, like, I don't know, it was strange in that way. And I was also talking to another band recently, like, just a two-piece. And they've been on that band called IMY3. And they're on, like, a really long tour, and they've been playing kind of a variety of different venues. Mm-hmm. And the ones that they say work best are the small ones. But, of course, they're a two-piece, so, like, their music is, like, exceedingly sparse. So I was kind of wondering, from your perspective, like, you've played at least a number of shows with the full band, like, is there an ideal venue, or, like, what kind of space is the music suited for, you think?
I like it really, really dark, like, in terms of the lighting.
Yeah.
I guess we played at Petite Bourse a few weeks ago, and that went really, really well. And I really enjoyed the almost claustrophobic sense of, like, just everyone crammed in there. And even the stage was, like, you know, the size of this carpet. And so we're all just kind of, like, I mean, it did limit us in some ways in the fact that, like, usually I go kind of do some feedback with my amp and stuff, and we need enough space to move about. So I wasn't able to do that. Just because everyone was, like, in the way. But the vibe was really cool. We played a much, much bigger venue in Toronto, which is, like, this vintage clothing warehouse.
Okay.
That, I don't know about square feet, but, I don't know, it could probably hold, like, 400 or 500 people. And it was in, like, an old industrial building of some kind, and the ceilings were 20, 25 feet tall or something like that. And we were playing in this, one of these, like, skate things. What are they called again? And the word is
a bowl?
It wasn't a bowl. It's like a half pipe.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We were playing in a half pipe. And, the crowd was really cool, like, a lot of people came out, but sonically, it wasn't really treated at all for reflections and stuff like that, so the sound was a little bit more unpredictable. We had a bit of trouble hearing ourselves on stage. It was a really awesome show, but I guess, like, the small intimate venues are really cool to play. I'm looking forward to playing at Casa on June 6th, which I played there many times before with this band and other things, but it's always a good experience. And then, yeah, Soterania is also really great. All these venues in that family are generally a pretty good bet, and they usually have good sound people, so
yeah.
That's a pretty essential element, is getting someone who can set the levels right and you can trust.
Yeah. One thing that I've been curious about, like, because Petite Urse is, like, the smallest of all of these, mm-hmm. and also, I mean, it was formerly Ursa and had been around a while, but I've been curious whether there'd be, like, we're talking about, like, the influence of bands like Duster, and then also when you have like the physical landscape of noise complaints being on the rise, mm-hmm. and like the death of venues, the death of like DIY venues and that sort of thing, and like part of the issue being noise, I've been really curious if there would be like a resurgence of quiet music in in the wake of that. I don't feel like it's happened yet.
I mean, that just sounds kind of sad, honestly.
Yeah, because like you don't want to come, like the reason people make music is not because they're physically constrained, they're making it because they want to make it. But I've been curious if there would be like some shift towards,
I don't know. I guess it kind of reminds me of like doing like a silent disco or something where everyone's just like dancing with their headphones on or something. I don't know. For me, it being loud is kind of very essential part of it. I mean, not, you know, painfully loud necessarily, but like I've been in some people's rehearsal spaces and stuff and they're rehearsing like four times as loud as we're rehearsing, but I don't know, interesting idea. I just think it's probably a little less compelling if everyone's quiet, but then again, I mean, people go to see unamplified classical music all the time, but those people are projecting their voices and using their instruments in a very, I guess also those settings are usually very carefully designed to amplify the noise as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a big tragedy about all the venues closing. I mean, every time I drive past Divan Orange, what used to be Divan Orange on Saint-Laurent, it's kind of now just another clothing store. And then there's a really great venue on Saint-Laurent, Saint-Viateur, right on the corner there. What was it called? Kajibi. And it was like a cafe, like run by a collective or something. And you could just book it for super, super cheap. And they would like feed you dinner and stuff every time you played. I'm sure they like probably lost money on feeding these people dinner. Cause I mean, we had some, I mean, I played there a long, long time ago, but a lot of these places are just getting wiped out by their noise complaints, but also just like rising real estate prices and rising rents. And so, but I mean, there's still a lot of stuff going on in Montreal in terms of venues. I guess I used to really be into the techno scene here, like very heavily in that scene from like 2014, 2015 or so until like 2020. And I feel like that has experienced a more severe, like all these venues have been exterminated.
Yeah.
Like back in the day, there was this building on Durocher and Vaubien, and there'd be like all these lofts and basement units, and there'd be like three raves going on at the same time every weekend, every Friday, Saturday. And now there's like a condo right next to it, and the landlords like kind of renovated everyone. And that's kind of been a pattern. So I feel like just the infrastructure for like rock music, like shows at little places like Casa and stuff like that, it's kind of been a more resilient thing compared to like big spaces where you can play extremely loud techno until like 8 a.m.
Yeah.
Which it's sort of a more unique set of demands.
I feel like with that too, there's a different like critical mass that you need to reach for that to be like in terms of the number of people and the number of shows going on. Maybe, I mean, that's something that I'm totally outside of, but at the same time I can imagine like you need to be able to draw like
I mean it's way more about like there's like a people power element to it, like the whole thing. I mean, any show, it's the, you know, dialogue between the performer and the audience to a certain extent. But yeah, if it's like an underground techno rave or something, it's really, the audience is really kind of fueling that. And it doesn't really work if you've got like 25 people there compared to like, you know, a show with some more like intimate, you know, guitar based music. Can really work with a smaller crowd. But if you show up to like a rave and it's like this little stragglers and
yeah,
you kind of want it to be a mass movement type of experience, which it really was for a long time here. And there is still stuff happening. I'm kind of not as clued into the scene, but it's definitely not anything like it was.
I eavesdropped on like an interview a while ago. I think it got published in some magazine that I forget the name of, but someone interviewing someone else who organizes a bunch of these, and the slow kind of like exodus of the spaces from, I think, from the island itself, or like them moving further and further away, and then having to like bus people to these things, and also like the sort of different like clashes of like, I guess in some ways not quite selecting the crowd that would show up, but like the, when you have like different groups of people and who goes to what shows and these things like being sort of separate from each other. It was interesting, but it was also like, it also had all the characteristics of like the loss of DIY spaces all over. Yeah, it was definitely interesting to hear someone from outside of all of that, and like the degree to which people would go to like make it to one of these things, or all of the effort that would go into running one of these spaces. Like, it's an insane amount of work.
Oh, it's an extremely thankless task.
Yeah,
like just generally, DIY concert stuff, like if you're the people doing the stuff, like the actual logistics, especially if they're not even playing that night or something, it's kind of a masochistic thing. Like, you're just putting your money up, you know, I mean, some people make some money with it, but like you're putting your money up and you're very likely to lose money, and you're likely to potentially get, you know, harassed or fined by cops, and then you've got like audience safety stuff, like, oh, like, you know, people are going to be intoxicated, and what if someone falls down the stairs, or there's some sort of security incident, you need to make sure that the crowd is safe, and then if it's not, then it could be blamed on you. So there's just so many things that could go wrong, I guess. It's tough.
Yeah, I think with the like the more like rock oriented venues, like so many of them being run by, they call them like the Casa people. I mean, that in itself seems to be like, when we go to like the topic of money, at least, like, you know, even if one venue, it's like possible to take more risks in that way. If like one venue or one show doesn't pull in enough money, you have enough other things going on for that to be like, you know, for that to smooth over in the end. But then at the same time, it also turns into like a weak point where it's like just, you know, if it's just one group of people running all of this, like if that falls apart.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if for some reason like the Casa group or whatever had I'm not really sure about like what their ownership or anything is, but if something happened and they like all got bought out or management changed and decided to like jack up prices like 400% or something like that, it would be pretty catastrophic. I mean, there's other good venues still, like Lesco Griff, like some other ones on Saint-Denis. And I don't know, like it's kind of crazy, like we were looking at booking Barlet Ritz, where people used to play all the time, like pretty kind of low rent affairs, and they were like asking for I think like $900 or something to book it for a night, which is absolutely insane. They were like, oh, it comes with coat check person and door person and security, and I'm like, I don't need any of those things. It used to be maybe $150 or $200 or something like that, but that's, yeah, it's nice that you can still rent Soterania or Casa or one of these venues for a reasonable amount of money and make some money at the end of the night.
Yeah, I got to Barlet Ritz for the first time like two nights ago, I guess, to see Preoccupations. Another band, Still Depths, and then Lavoro, like from Vancouver, I think, and then Toronto. They were both really good.
Sick.
But it was my first time being there. I was surprised at how small it was for like this kind of, I think, again, sort of outsider perspective of like, it has like a large venue status, like the kind of bands that will play there, like lots of out of town stuff. But then that just doesn't make sense when you actually get inside of it.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe something changed with the management a while ago or something, but I used to go there all the time. I used to actually have a job sometimes there, just like, because it's really out of the way on this quiet, kind of somewhat desolate strip. I mean, it's not out of the way, but it's on a slightly on, like, there's not a lot of pedestrian action on that little strip of Jean-Talon. And so when this was back in 2018 or something like that, but when they would have, I guess they had some problems with like people coming in and harassing the bartenders or something.
Okay.
When there'd be like one bartender working, especially like one female bartender working. And so they started paying me, it was actually my friend who had the gig most of the time, but just to like sit at the bar.
Oh, nice.
So that it wouldn't be completely empty, just to like have a someone else there.
Yeah.
To kind of deter people from coming in. And it was a pretty sweet gig because I was just paid to sit at the bar. But only did that one a few times. But yeah, I mean, I saw a bunch of great shows there. I saw Alex G play there.
Okay.
Way back in the day, must have been 2016 or something like that. And that was a really awesome show.
Yeah,
I can taking imagine. Requests from the crowd and kind of before he really blew up.
Yeah.
But he had already put out so much good music by that point.
Yeah, I feel like there's a tipping point where all of a sudden it like, I mean, I don't want to say like become, when something like becomes mainstream, but to have enough material out there that you can actually be familiar with a band before seeing them live, but at the same time it not being like you're not totally distanced from the musician either.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a special period, I think.
Yeah.
Something you mentioned earlier was like a dialogue between the band, the musician, and the crowd. What are you going for with Golden Star in that way?
I guess we've talked a lot about just general city stuff and
that still counts.
Stuff and not so much about the actual project, but I don't know. Not sure if you're going to edit this or anything.
Probably not.
That's fine. So, yeah, I guess I really don't like when I go to a show and the band is like overly self, like, what's the term I'm looking for? Like self-flagellating or I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but, I guess I like to talk to the crowd, but just keep it kind of conversational or something. Definitely, one thing that I've been, a funny little thing I've been trying to deal with the last couple shows is like, I don't know, the music is very serious for the most part and dark in a lot of the time and dealing with sort of very sort of dark feelings, and so for the most part we're playing it looking kind of somber or something. But then I'm like, when I'm playing on stage, I kind of, my mind wanders quite a bit because I know the songs really well, so I'm thinking about different things, and then I get this, it's kind of like when you're in class and when you're a kid and your friend is like making a face at you and you're trying not to like laugh, teachers looking at you or something, and so I start to like have to suppress like a like shit-eating grin.
Okay.
Right when I'm like playing like the most sort of despairing little phrase or something, and yeah, it's something that I'm trying to deal with recently. But I don't think there's anything wrong with smiling when you're on stage, but I don't know, maybe it's something I need to sort of, I guess, yeah, I mean, I like interacting with the crowd and talking with them. And the thing with these shows that we're doing, it's kind of funny. It's almost like the crowd is standing at a classical music concert or something, because there's not really much people can do in terms of like bodily movements to, like, I mean, there's like swaying. Some of the, like when we covered Zurich Is Stained, it's a bit more of a mid-tempo kind of thing. People can kind of get a little bit of a dance kind of thing going. But I think it's fine to just have a few hundred people standing in a room still listening to music. That's all right with me.
No, I agree. Having been in one of those rooms, it definitely worked well. And I feel too, like, there's still like a really large impact from sparse music, because then it's like the dynamic of the music being played, like, you can kind of feel it in everyone, where it's like, I feel like there's a difference between an audience that is like unengaged with the music and an audience that is still and engaged with the music. And that's something that I think at the show that I saw you guys play, like, I was able to pick up on. And like, you guys were obviously, like you said before, like, very constrained with the stage, but at the same time, I feel like that was like a, like, an ability to almost like freeze the room, and then also be able to like play with that.
Well, yeah, that's reminds me of, I mean, something that I think is mentioned in some documentary about Elliot Smith.
Okay.
Where, I mean, I'd love to have the power of that Elliot Smith. I mean, he's definitely one of my musical heroes, but he, like, someone, I think it was his manager, was talking about like when he would start playing and everyone would just like the air was like sucked out of the room, like everyone was just like kind of made still and transfixed. And I guess that is kind of an effect that I would like to try to go for, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I think sparseness in music is something that can accomplish that. Like, the discussion I had with the band IMY3, like, they're talking about like the, just like an approach of being like playing less almost. And then I had seen it before, local act Girl With Dream. She was playing like a, it's just like a solo folk set, and it was right after Dresser had played, which is like very different from that. And this crowd that was like kind of moving around a little bit loud and the set's starting, and she just play one note in silence and do that a few times, and all of a sudden the crowd just like clues in. And I feel it's also interesting to see like how, like, when you start to be able to pick up on the engagement that a crowd has with the music, because there are only so many ways that a crowd can even express that. Like, you mentioned like this dialogue back and forth, but it's obviously there are way more options that the musician has, but it's also like within like a framework. And something strange that I've seen, and it came to mind when you mentioned, especially like you're trying to suppress the shit-eating grin, is like listening to readings. So people like reading short stories or poetry. One author whose readings I quite like, James Tate, a lot of his stuff is very comedic, but at times it is not. But at the same time, I'd listen to some of these like public readings he'd done, and people would laugh, but they would keep laughing through every single like poignant part. And it felt like they were, this was like kind of, and this is something that I was talking about it like by email with a friend. And he suggested, it's like, yeah, it's kind of the only way that a group can collectively respond out loud to something like that is. And once, I feel like once you get into a particular mode, you just kind of sustain that. And it can be really jarring to see or to hear or just like feel presence that feels like somewhat out of line with what's going on. But but then it's also like that juxtaposition that makes these, that's why you want to laugh when like there's something that you're trying to avoid laughing, right? Like, well, okay, going back to the music itself, when we first spoke, one of the things that you had mentioned was an interest in, I guess, different moods to approach. Mm-hmm. You were talking about, I'll use the word misanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure,
mentioning
that's a good
like
word.
Sonic Youth stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe, because you'd already described, I guess, the music that appears in the EP and the mm-hmm. stuff that you play now as dark. But what would you say is changing, or what do you want to explore emotionally and tonally going forward?
Yeah, these ideas of like desolation, hopelessness, misanthropy, all of those stuff, that's all very much there on certain tracks on the last EP. And I think it's a pretty healthy way to kind of express and explore these ideas, because it's not something that is so easily, you know, talked about in casual conversation.
Or yeah.
I don't even want to talk about like that with my friends when I'm having a beer or whatever. Like,
yeah.
I'd rather express these ideas in a certain venue, in an artistic way. I don't know. It's interesting. I actually have been finding it less easy for me to come up with these like really sort of hopeless, defeated sort of harmonic and melodic sequences. Recently, I feel like my intuition has been going towards more like more in the range of wistful.
Yeah.
Than as like sort of depressed as some of the other stuff is. But then yeah, I do really like the sort of like Sonic Youth stuff of like this sort of misanthropic would be one term, or like bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
And that bitterness is something I'm kind of, because it's very cathartic, honestly, to be on stage and express a feeling like that. And I don't know, it's something I'm trying to explore for sure. But yeah, a lot of the new songs are more sort of melancholic and a bit sweeter, maybe.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely don't want the project to be one-dimensional in terms of the sort of like emotional landscape that it creates. But I don't know, it's kind of funny, like the second song on the EP is called VS, which is actually short for very silly, because I was like in the studio in my rehearsal space I was working on some song that I thought was really good. So I was like, and it was like dark and serious, and I was really trying to make some things work. It just wasn't working. I don't even remember what song it was. I'm not sure if I ever finished it, but I was very frustrated with it after like 2.5 hours of just kind of like trying stuff and it not exactly working. And then I was like, well, this whole session has been a bit of a bust. I might as well just like do something like different and just not so oriented towards creating a specific thing. And anyway, I kind of was just like, okay, I'm gonna like just mess around and record something and see if I can like get something down quickly. And I kind of came up with all those elements really, really quickly in like half an hour or something, just like one after the other, like only one or two takes for each thing. And I thought it was interesting, and it kind of reminded me of like Built to Spill a bit or something like that. But it's definitely tonally a bit different from the rest of the stuff on the EP. And like initially I was just like, I kind of just chalked it up to like oh, like, this is kind of a fun little thing. It's kind of stupid. So I named the file very silly. And then I showed Meg, who writes a lot of the lyrics and is, you know, collaborator on the project, my girlfriend Meg. And I was driving with her and I put on the demo and I was like, oh, this is like some stupid little thing that I recorded. And she was like, oh no, this is like really awesome. And I guess that perspective was helpful, and eventually we like finished the song and it ended up on the EP. So sometimes it's useful to just go into it without much of a structure or anything.
Yeah, I think this goes back to what you were saying before too about not wanting to be have like too narrow of a landscape, and like if you get caught in that type of a constraint where it's like, I feel like the main thing that ends up being important for like artistic creation, I guess, is like poignance, where it's not so much about like trying to, maybe not at the start necessarily trying to attack like a particular feeling, but rather mm-hmm. just like approaching whatever ends up being poignant in the moment. Or
yeah, oh for sure. I mean, there's definitely sort of ideals that I try to go by in my music that are not exact, like that are sort of cross different emotional areas or whatever. Like I try to really have a sense of this is something I've kind of noticed when I was a teenager. I was like, the best music feels really inevitable.
Okay.
So I really try to write music where it's like, wow, it sounded like that had to happen. Like this wasn't a choice necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I even kind of approach songwriting like that a lot of the time, where I come up, a lot of the time the first element is like a guitar riff or a certain chord voicing or something, and usually I'm just sitting around and sometimes even like watching something and just messing around, and I come up with this first element, and then I really just try to not put my ego or expectations onto like, I need to write this kind of song or that kind of song, and just respond to what is there. Mm-hmm. So like, you've got this first element, like how can I incorporate that into like a song structure, like where does it go after that, and really just answer what the music wants to be there. Almost it's I'm not actually mystical about the process like yeah. that, but it's useful to think about it like that, because I think that's kind of the most, like at the heart of it, that's the most effective way of going about it. Mm-hmm.
I think someone I spoke to last night, I guess he does, I guess you could call the stuff he does like curatorial, or like dealing with, okay, I shouldn't even say because I don't know well enough, but like he looks at a lot of art, and like I mm-hmm. think for like residencies for new artists and that sort of thing, and one of the things he described in seeing like how people develop as artists, and he mostly deals with like visual art, I think, mm-hmm. was moving from a framing that is being an artist that focuses on a particular subject to one that eventually develops into an artist with a unique perspective, where it's mm-hmm. not so much focused on trying to, you know, describe, let's say, one thing, but rather mm-hmm. being able to approach many things with like some sort of identity.
Sure.
But yeah, I feel like that's part of this whole process of trying to do things that are inevitable in a sense, or approach things in like a almost naturalistic way. Now I'm curious about how the music has changed over time, because I like, how long has all of the material that, say, made it onto the EP, how long has it been in the works, and like how's that sort of process changed, because it's you but there are also mm-hmm. the other band members in there.
Yeah, I can talk about that for sure. So basically the I started writing guitar music when I was in high school. My dad bought me a guitar from a pawn shop, and I sort of started learning to play like Hey Jude and stuff like that. Yeah. And so I was writing some rudimentary songs that I still remember some of them, they're not that great, but you have to write a lot of bad songs before you write good songs. And so I had this sort of like, I was writing kind of singer-songwriter guitar stuff. I guess I was really influenced by the Velvet Underground at that point. What I was writing was not really sounding like that, because, you know, there's this gap of like what you can actually do and what you want to do. So that was when I was a teenager, and then I came to Montreal and I was like very swept up in this like underground electronic music, like house and techno and jungle, IDM, ambient world, because that's kind of where, and that people are doing really interesting stuff, really beautiful, but also brutal and like physically, like just, there was so much actual stuff happening, and you go to these raves or events and lose your mind a little bit.
Yeah.
So I was kind of doing that for quite a while, and working on my computer a lot and working with synths. And the scene sort of became less interesting to me, and maybe I got a bit burnt out of it, and as I talked about, like, venues closed, and I guess I was a bit tired of it all. And then around 2020 or so would be like the earliest, like Torn a Twain and Asleep.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pretty much the main structures of those songs were written 5 years ago.
Okay.
And I was just, at that point, me and Chris Stewart was playing drums, and Nick on bass, Nick Castonguay and Zach MacArthur on guitar. And we were just kind of like, I guess it wasn't really that serious. Like, we were kind of just going into the space and jamming together. We were kind of playing a lot of like sort of dark wavy adjacent sort of stuff.
Okay.
Like these like that kind of thing. Because I guess we were all, I mean, Chris has his band Body Wash, but Nick and Zach were also both like in the more like electronic music world. So this was a bit of just something different. And then during COVID, it was just like, a lot of time to sit at home with the guitar, and kept writing songs. And it was a bit of like, the whole thing was happening really like in fits and starts. Like, we'd get together and rehearse and like have like one show or something, and then not rehearse for like 9 months. And a lot of the time I was a pretty like depressed and unmotivated for a lot of the time. And so it was hard to kind of get the whole thing going, but I knew that what I had written, like, it felt kind of special, and like I should follow through with it. And then I met Meg 2.5 years ago, and we started dating, and I was showing her that music, and she was really into it, which was nice to hear someone was into it. And she actually really helped me kind of finish some of those songs. I guess writing lyrics was a hard part for me, like so much more vulnerable in a certain sense compared to like writing, like coming up with a melody on the guitar or riff or something. But even like Asleep, like the end of that song, she came up with the melody and the lyrics for that last chorus. And then in other songs, it was, sometimes more me with the lyrics, more collaborative, and just having someone to like bounce those ideas off of. And also, I guess it's nice when, I guess I respect her taste more than anyone's probably, so it's really, really, really useful to be able to write something and come home and be like, hey, like, what do you think of this? And get that perspective and respect that perspective, and then you can, of course, you do have to have your own agency as well when it comes to it, and not define your work by what someone else thinks. But yeah, so I guess many of these songs were sort of bubbling up over the past 5 years. There were other songs that were written and recorded and never released, or that I wasn't fully happy with. We had like a session recording live off the floor like 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, that I was kind of really inspired by, like how Slint recorded and stuff, and I was like, okay, we're gonna do it like Slint and just do it live off the floor. But it didn't really work out because we weren't quite tight enough at the time. Like now I think we're actually really tight, but
I'd agree, yeah.
Back then it didn't really work out. So there were all these kind of like attempts that didn't quite work out. And then I guess last summer, I'm 30 years old and I was 29 then. And I was like, I kind of need to like get something going. Like, what am I doing with my life so much? And I kind of gave myself an ultimatum of like, I need to like really finish this project and actually get it going. Cause I don't know, like, yeah, it was just files on a computer that I would show my friends, and people would be like, oh wow, this is amazing or whatever. But also it's your friends. So
yeah.
I mean, I trust my friends, but they're also still your friends. And so, yeah, like summer 2024, I got really serious about finishing everything up, and I got in touch with my friend Francis Latrey, who he like produces music and DJs under the name Priori, and he was down to mix the record. So I'd worked with him before on this like techno project in like 2019. He mixed this Perishing Thirst album for me, and we had a really good experience. Like, I just like go to his studio and sit with him while he does the whole thing. And I guess honestly, having the deadline of like, this is when it's gonna be mixed, it was like, okay, we need to like record everything. We have to have everything like fully done. All the lyrics have to be figured out. Cause before, and I still do this to a certain extent, I'll write a song and I have the melody and stuff, but I'll just kind of like fake the words. Even okay. Like live, like at the last show, like there's one of the new songs, like I didn't have words yet. So I kind of like just was like singing sounds that sound like words softly. So it was like, okay, we need to actually like get this all down. And that was really helpful, and it was also like really great to hear it coming together and sounding more professional with getting it mixed and stuff. And then after it came out, the response was like really nice, I guess. Mm-hmm. More than I anticipated. Like, people were really into it, which is great, and definitely put some wind under my sails to put some more stuff out. But yeah, also, yeah, so Meg was definitely a big part of finishing it. Chris played drums on almost all the songs, and I've been doing music with him for a long time, and I really respect his opinion. So that, like, Chris recorded the drums on 4 of the tracks, and also this guitar part on the like counting sections of 7 Score. Like, there's two guitar parts, there's just like chords, and then there's this like sort of spidery higher sort of part, and he came up with that, which was really, really good for the song. But for the most part, everything else instrumental was me. And Zach and Nick have been involved in the like a live setup, but also both of them, I respect their taste a lot, and useful to have their feedback and everything. And they're gonna be, I'm definitely gonna have them a bit more involved in terms of like recording some of their stuff for the next project, because I mean, it's been helpful now, like writing new songs and bringing it to the band and sometimes playing it live even before recording, because then they can mm-hmm. sort of give their spin on things. Sometimes I write stuff and I'm like, okay, like this is what I want. Sometimes I write something and I really want it to be played exactly like that. Sometimes I write something and I'm like, you know, you can change it up a little bit. And sometimes I don't write a part and I'm like, okay, but you can try to figure it out. So I'm very grateful to everyone who's collaborated on the project. And then there's also my friend Jacob Sexsmith, who played drums on Seven Score, the first song of the EP. And he's also a great drummer, and going to be working with him as well going forward. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny, like, people are like, oh, like, is it like your project, or is it like a solo project? Or, like, it's definitely like my project, but it's also certainly a collaborative project, and I couldn't have done it without collaborating. So yeah,
I think with these sorts of things it really matters to have like critical voices to help refine things as they go along. And I think it's a pattern that I've seen with various bands. Like, they start out as like a single person making mm-hmm. music, and then it's, even if it is still like their project in a way, like, and I used air quotes here for mm-hmm. everyone who can't actually see me doing yeah. that, like it's like this slow inclusion of people into like the process of making mm-hmm. it's interesting to see how people's music changes in light of that. And I think, I mean, obviously you talked about the reception of the EP, it was very good, and I think that's something that was almost surprising to me, because I've seen bands that kind of, when they first show up on my radar, it is as like a new band mm-hmm. in a way, and you can see sometimes, especially in a live performance, like the rough edges of something transitioning from one person making music and then getting other people to play it. And yeah, you guys felt very refined when I saw you play, and also like the dynamics between like you and Meg's vocals, like mm-hmm. they're really, really restrained, and they come out really, really well. Like, they add a lot of yeah, dynamism to the music.
I think like she has an incredible voice for the music, and especially, and like, I remember showing like a friend of mine some of these songs like 3-4 years ago, and he was like, oh, they're really good, but like they're just like missing something. And I also felt like they were missing something, so I guess I was kind of like sitting on some of them just mm-hmm. like, because I didn't feel like they were complete. And then I feel like Meg's vocals really did add like a really, I think also just like having that sort of like kind of somewhat raw sounding but like intimate female vocal part can really add a huge dimension mm-hmm. to, and sort of life, like lived in and human dimension to something that is sometimes kind of more abstract sounding. So that juxtaposition is pretty good. Yeah, we're definitely, I was just writing a new song yesterday and coming up with a vocal part with Meg, and sounding good.
Nice. And do you think the process now is more straightforward? Because you talked about more or less this 5-year span of like things that you just said, like they were good but weren't complete. And it seems now that you have maybe a better idea of like when something is finalized, or at least like the framework for that. Do you think it's more straightforward going?
Yeah, for sure. Which I think is a good and a bad thing. Mostly good. Like, I think I've definitely honed my craft, and everyone else is also honing their craft. And I mean, like you said, in terms of the band, like everyone who plays in the band are very tuned in. Like, they understand like what we're going for, and mm-hmm. I guess like have a keen appreciation of beauty. So
okay.
That really helps. But anyway, so just to get back to your question, Yeah, I mean, it is more straightforward for sure, because like with experience writing more and more songs, you get like, I kind of have a bit more of a defined process a little bit. But then you also run into the trap of, oh, am I like writing too many songs that sound a bit too similar or yeah. something like...
If it's formulaic.
Yeah, you're trying to navigate using formulas, but then also breaking the formulas. And so it's a bit interesting like that. Like I had my guitar tuned to this really nice tuning that Pavement used on Zurich Is Stained as well as In the Mouth of the Desert, where you tune the bottom string down two tones to C, and then the second bottom string down one tone, and then the top four strings are standard. And I was writing, I probably wrote like 15 or 20 like songs or beginnings of songs in that tuning, and I was like, okay, some of these are just a bit too, I mean, certain tunings make you guide you to certain chords a lot more, and I was like, okay, like some of these I can keep and some of these are I have to discard because like they're just a little bit too similar in some ways. But yeah, it's been a challenge for sure. I guess like the first EP was over the course of 5 years of songwriting, much less intense in various points. Like there were like 6 month periods where I probably didn't even touch a guitar at certain points. But now it's like I want to keep putting out the same level of quality, but I have like way less like time. Like I'm not putting out the next project in 5 years.
Yeah.
Because everyone will have forgotten about us in 5 years if we don't put out anything. So, I mean, I'm trying to finish something by, like we're mixing in September, so have everything recorded by then. And it is a bit of like pressure to try to get a nice crop of songs that, like I hold the work to a really high standard, I think, so. And there is something like, I don't know, it's definitely gonna be different, and there's something maybe special that won't be replicated exactly on the second thing that was on the first thing, especially maybe because of how the first thing came about, like in this sort of very drawn out and strange context. And yeah, I'm just trying to write a lot of songs to try to make sure that I can like cull from that and
yeah.
get the best ones, put those out.
I guess the last thing I'll ask is more on, more or less just bands that you'd like to mention in terms of bands that were influential. You also mentioned like looking for local bands that would kind of suit like the sound that you're going for. And you've got a list, it seems.
I'll just attend to my phone because it'll be easier to remember.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, off the cuff, like, I mean, my favorite local band is one that we've played with a couple of times called Twine.
Okay, yeah.
They're really awesome, like great songwriting. They're more like screamo, emo-ish, but
yeah.
also have a sort of like, they have like really heavy, but then like somewhat like more like beautiful sections. Yeah. They're really good and very raw. Really awesome. In terms of stuff that was, yeah, I mean, Slint and Duster were pretty big. Helvetia was also really influential, which is like one of the members of Duster's side project. Yeah, I mean, Elliot Smith, Sonic Youth, going through here, Sprain.
Okay, yeah.
I actually kind of like revisited
their
2018 album recently, and I was like, actually the album art's kind of like oddly similar, which I didn't clock. Like we didn't do that consciously at all. But yeah, that 2018 thing is really awesome. Alex G, yeah. Huge influence. I mean, I really think he's like the most gifted and like, I think he's kind of like the most exciting and biggest thing in like guitar music over the past 10 years or so, at least. Like, he just has such a prolific output, and the quality is so high in terms of the songwriting, and it's so varied. Like, DSU by Alex G, that album is like incredibly influential on me. And all of these influences, like, I mean, I think it's best when I try to combine them and start something new whenever I mean, it happens quite often that I write something and it's like, oh, like, this sounds, you know, too much like Alex G or Sonic Youth or something, like something specific. I never want it to sound too much like one thing. Yeah, so some other bands, Unwound, this sort of singer-songwriter, Lisa Germano.
Okay, yeah.
Really awesome. The Breeders, in a weird way, I guess. Let's see here. Yeah, if I had to do it off the top of my head, I definitely couldn't do it, but having Spotify likes is helpful. And I'm definitely forgetting a lot of things. Oh yeah, the AF1 album.
Okay.
It's like, I'm not sure if you... This one?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. It's another...
I heard like, AF1.
Yeah, it's like EIAFUAWN.
Everything is all fucked up and
yeah,
whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really amazing album.
Yeah.
The Microphones. Let's see here. I mean, that's a pretty nice little group of bands that influenced us, I guess. As I mean, everything else as yeah. Well.
There's always going to be more, right?
Yes. I mean, it's also been really interesting now after putting out the project and hearing, like, you know, there's been a little bit of, like, blog coverage and whatever, and people are like, oh, this sounds like this and this and this, and a lot of the time it's bands I've never heard of, but often it's bands that I've like gotten into and I like, so it's cool to sort of reverse engineer it like yeah. That. And then also, weirdly enough, like the Spotify, like people also like sort of thing, like you go to the bottom of an artist page and you like see like the other recommended.
Okay.
Like there's a couple of bands I've found through that I've gotten into. Like there's this band called The Furniture Group from New York that are pretty cool. What else? Sta Dormida is a really cool band. I put one of their songs in the NTS mix that I did, but they're very elusive. Like they have no social media.
Okay.
It's like STA space Dormida. They're like on Bandcamp and I think on Spotify and stuff, but really into them.
Cool. All right. Well, I think we'll cap it there.
Cool.
Thanks.
Handshake.
Yeah, cool. All right.